returning to the United States on Monday, and I'll be taking with me many wonderful memories. Let's see. Oops. Just, it's nice to have something in my hand. I first wanted to ask you how many of you have either one read read either one of my books or parts of any of my books. Two, read the issue in Soteria or the articles in there about me. Or three, attended one of the other sessions which I spoke this week. So that would be on Monday or on Wednesday. I just get a sense of hands that of people that are very good. Okay, that's what I thought. What I thought was that at least that with this audience that I'd be dealing with a number of people who were acquainted with my basic ideas. And so I decided that I wasn't going to give a new presentation of my my fundamental thesis. Some of that will come out probably again in summary form, particularly in the second session. What I wanted to do in this first session was to talk about what really is one of the main themes of my writing, or perhaps a kind of theological one of the theological central points, which becomes especially pronounced in my most recent book, Searching Her Own Mystery, and that is Israel Christology. But I don't want to, on Monday at the Jules Isaac Foundation, I gave a whole lecture about Israel Christology in which I went through a set of texts from both the Hebrew Bible, talking about Daniel 7 and the Son of Man as an individual and a corporate figure, the servant of the Lord in Isaiah as an individual and a corporate figure, the Messiah, particularly under the title Son of God as an individual and a corporate figure. And then I did a reading through a number of texts in Matthew chapters 1 through 4, showing how a portrayal of Jesus as the individual embodiment of the Jewish people gets expressed within one particular set of texts within the New Testament. I'm not going to cover that ground again. What I want to actually do in this first session is give you a little bit of a history of how I came to this set of convictions about Israel Christology, and its significance for me. As Professor Mugger said at the beginning, if you as I'm going along, if you have questions that you want to ask, just raise your hand as we're going. The sessions here are rather short, and so there's not like a separate time that we have for discussion. So presentation and discussion, it's all one together. Now, I need to really begin with my own personal experience, because I didn't arrive at the positions I hold by doing a deductive Bible study. I've done a lot of Bible study, and a lot of my writing is exegetical. But I really came to the biblical texts with a set of questions that came from my own personal experience. And the personal experience that was especially relevant here is the fact that from early on in my own relationship with Jesus, one of the most powerful places where I encountered him was in the synagogue and in the the Jewish prayer book and in the actual practice of Judaism. Now, of course, Jesus is not mentioned in the synagogue prayers. Jesus is not explicitly a part of the framework of the Siddur or of Jewish practice. Far from it. But the fact of my own experience was that as I worshipped within a synagogue, a traditional synagogue context, I was encountering Jesus there. Of course, I had already experienced him outside of that context, so I was bringing him in with me. But my own sense was that it was not simply Jesus in me. My sense was that in the midst of this synagogue community that would not in any way explicitly acknowledge Jesus, that Jesus was in their midst and that I was encountering him there. Or this prayer book, this text that is the cumulative result, the cumulative fruit of the Jewish people's relationship with God over a couple of thousand years, that in making that prayer book my own, I was encountering Jesus there, much as I think the early followers of Jesus encountered Jesus in the midst of the Psalms and in the midst of the prayers of Israel that they knew in their own day, or in the midst of temple worship as it's presented in the book of Acts.
May I ask you, will you also mention something in this part about your coming to faith in Jesus?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't, yeah, because I just want to, okay. I'm just trying to set the stage here specifically for the question of Israel Christology and how I came to this particular conviction. Mm-hmm. And so, the basic question for me was, how can this be? How can this be that I'm encountering Jesus in this place where his name cannot be mentioned? How can it be that I'm encountering Jesus in the practice of entering and internalizing personally the prayers of the Siddur, which were all composed by people over a 2,000-year period who, of course, had no interest, no positive interest in the person of Jesus? How could this be? And so over many years, this was a question that was in my mind as I was reading the New Testament, as I was reflecting on my own faith in Jesus the Messiah. I think one key source for me that put it together was when I read a Jewish theologian by the name of Will Herberg. I think test here the... Do I have the enough rope here? I'm right near the end of my my line. Okay. Will Herbert.
You have some more now.
Okay. You are free now.
Thank you. Will Herbert was a Jewish theologian who wrote especially in the 1950s. And he was very, very much influenced by neo-Orthodox Christian theology, particularly the writings of Reinhold Niebuhr and to some extent Karl Barth. And he was also influenced by Franz Rosenzweig and this Jewish attempt to understand Christianity in a positive way, which connected it to Judaism. And so Will Herberg argued that all relationship with God is mediated through covenant. That there's not some kind of universal relationship with God that God simply has with humanity in general, but that relationship with God comes through covenantal initiatives of God. And of course, the fundamental covenantal initiative is God's establishing of his covenant with the people of Israel. And so then he wanted to make a connection between God's covenant with Israel and the life of the Christian church. And so the way he did this was by arguing that Jesus was a kind of one-man Israel. This was the phrase that Will Herberg used. A one-man Israel. But that he was a one-man Israel for the nations of the world. So that when the Gentiles were joined to him, were baptized into him, were united to him by faith, they were thereby also being joined to Israel and to God's covenant. Now, I found this idea very, very intriguing. It captured this sense of the church's relationship to the Jewish people. And in a sense, Jesus' own relationship to the Jewish people as this microcosm, this individual embodiment of the life of the Jewish people. But of course, what it was lacking was any sense that this had profound implications for the Jewish people itself, other than by establishing this connection between the church of the nations, the Gentiles, and the Jewish people, which Herberg did think was of great significance for the Jewish people. But other than that, Jesus was one man Israel for the nations. But I felt like I had come across a key, something that had great import, even though Will Herberg hadn't drawn the implications from it that I thought needed to be drawn. And what struck me was Jesus as the one man Israel is not only one man Israel for the nations. He's one man Israel for the Jewish people. That he, in his embodiment of the life of Israel, he establishes as Israel's king an unbreakable bond with the Jewish people. He becomes the mystery, the hidden core of Jewish identity that will, in a hidden way, be shaping Jewish life and Jewish history for all time to come. That the incarnation establishes a kind of ontological connection between Jesus and not just humanity in a generic way. It does that too. But that it establishes this distinctive, particular ontological connection between Jesus and the Jewish people. And in a sense, only such a connection with the nations via the Jewish people and through that connection with the Jewish people. This opened up for me this way of interpreting the experience that I had within the synagogue and with the Siddur. Now, it was only later that I encountered the writings of N.T. Wright. And I found the writings of N.T. Wright to be very, very powerful and filled with insight. In some cases, N.T. Wright describes what he's doing as this attempt to recover the Jewishness of the gospel. And I think that's actually a fair description of what he goes about doing. He presents Jesus very much as this one man Israel. He presents Jesus as this microcosm of the people of Israel as a whole. And he seeks to argue against some sense of Jesus simply as one who comes as generic humanity. This gets expressed very in fascinating ways when he interprets Paul's Adam Christology. And this is reflected early on in N.T. Wright's work when he's interpreting Romans chapter 5 or 1 Corinthians chapter 15. What he says is that Jesus becomes Adam, becomes the second Adam, not in a direct way. He becomes the second Adam because Israel was in fact established by God to be the second Adam, to be the renewed humanity. And it's by virtue of being the embodiment of Israel that Jesus is the second Adam or the new Adam. In other words, Jesus' relationship to all of humanity, in a sense, is mediated through his participation in the life of the Jewish people and the life of the people of Israel. And then N.T. Wright goes through the entire framework of Jesus' own teaching, his redemptive work, and seeks to interpret it all in connection with Jesus as the individual embodiment of Israel's story. The story, understanding the story of Jesus as simply the story of Israel being told again. Now, again, I find many, many aspects of N.T. Wright's picture here to be very, very compelling. What I found is he was taking a core insight that I had received both from my own personal experience and then from reading Will Herberg. But now he was applying it in detail to a variety of different aspects of Jesus' teaching and work in a way, again, that had, I thought, a power to rethink the message of the gospel in a way that really did recover something about its fundamental Jewish character. Of course, what drops out utterly from N.T. Wright's picture is the Jewish people itself. He succeeds at recovering the Jewishness of the gospel. What he loses are the Jews. Because in the way in which N.T. Wright reads the New Testament, in the form of Israel Christology that N.T. Wright presents, Jesus so embodies the Jewish people. He so sums up the Jewish people. And he does it in such a way that in order to maintain your identity in Israel, in order to still be counted as part of Israel, you simply have to come to him and explicitly confess faith in him and enter into his community, the community of his disciples. And any Jews who do not do that thereby forfeit their own claim, the legitimacy of their own claim to be part of Israel. From that point on, Jewish history has really no particular significance beyond the history of any other particular people in the earth. And Jesus has no ongoing connection to that history beyond the connection he might have with the history of the Chinese or the Italians or the Poles. Now, that of course was something that struck me as profoundly
odd.
Odd. wrong, false, certainly false to my, again, to both my own experience, but also to what seemed to me to make most sense of both of history as well as my reading of the New Testament. And so what I saw in Jewish history was a pattern that struck me as being very clearly what you might call cruciform, that showed the Jewish people in many ways, and this is an insight of John Howard Yoder, in many ways to showing the Jewish people bearing a clearer witness to the teaching and life of Jesus and the cross of Jesus in its history than the church did as a whole. And that seemed to me to be something more than a coincidence. So, basically, this notion of Israel Christology is something that really runs through all of my writings. In the first book, in my first book, Post-Missionary Messianic Judaism, it's not the central theme because it's fundamentally a book about ecclesiology. But in the process of talking about this ecclesiology, Israel Christology emerges. I don't even know if I use the term within the book, but I do I do cover a number of New Testament texts that are relevant to it, and I do speak about Will Herberg and the notion of one man Israel. Israel Christology becomes much more central in my collection of essays, Israel and the People of God, and in the introduction Jennifer Rosner writes, I think she very accurately situates the my understanding of Israel Christology in relationship to the whole framework of my thinking. And then in the newest book, Searching Her Own Mystery, Israel Christology emerges as a theme in its own right and under that particular name. And then I try to develop that insight and particularly how it then impacts our understanding of ecclesiology and the relationship of the Jewish people and the church, which is more what I will focus on in our second session this morning. Now, so far, any questions so far from this? Yes?
Just to clarify, gather my words well. You say that N.T. Wright is one Israel, the embodiment of Israel?
Yes.
But then you branch up from what N.T. Wright says. He says that everybody who confesses Christ is God's people. But what is your point on that? Let Jews who do not confess Christ, are they God's people?
Yes.
Will they dwell forever in his presence?
Well, that's a separate question, I think. For me, that's a separate. I have the same question about the church, I don't see it any different. I treat the visibility of the church as very significant. I'm not particularly enthused about the a great emphasis on an invisible church. For me, the church is something as tangible as the Jewish people, and that will perhaps come off a bit in our discussion of ecclesiology. So for me, the church is a concrete reality that you can touch and that you can feel. Will everyone who is part of that concrete community, will they all at the end share life in the presence of God? That's a different question. I'd say the same thing about the Jewish people. I'd say this is the Jewish people are the people of God. They are Israel. How many of them as individuals will be sharing life with God in the world to come? That's another question. It's a separate question as far as I see it, from the basic question of ecclesiology of who is the people of God. So, Dave.
So, I have a question. If Jesus embodies a one-man Israel, and he relives the story of Israel, what was conversion to, or accepting him as a Messiah, what was it for, in what way was it a conversion for a Jew, so
yes.
to speak? Because Paul talks about
yes.
that some Jews didn't convert.
Yes.
But, you know, how...
Yes. Yes. Well, I think I'm not enthusiastic about the term conversion for Jews. There are a lot of reasons, for that, and I don't need to go into to all of them. But the fact is that in my observation, the framework of the way in which Jews experience what Jews experience when they come to faith in Jesus and what Gentiles experience when they come to faith in Jesus is actually two somewhat different things. There's actually a fascinating doctoral thesis by an Israeli Messianic Jew that was did an analysis of this, focusing specifically, she did a survey of Israelis who had come to faith in Jesus and asked them to, a set of questions about what it meant for them. And she drew a set of conclusions that really confirmed my own both personal experience and my sense of the experience of both my Jewish and non-Jewish friends. It's this. It's that when Gentiles come to faith in Jesus, they experience what the term conversion is really an appropriate term. It's a sense of having your life simply turned around and discovering something that is like this completely new reality that changes absolutely everything. When Jews come to faith in Jesus, what we tend to experience and what these Israelis said in answering these questionnaires is they felt like they were simply coming back to themselves. That they were discovering who they actually had been all along, that they were understanding what it meant for Israel to be an Israeli, to be what they were, to understand what the significance of speaking Hebrew was, and to the significance of the Jewish holidays and etc. I think that simply the sense of coming back to who you are and experiencing simply a kind of realization, a fulfillment, a simple drawing out to its eschatological conclusion, you might say, what is already simply implanted in the Jewish soul and in Jewish life, as opposed to the sense of like a turnaround. Now, of course, there's also a turnaround, but the turnaround is different. It's like the turning around from sinful courses of life and a changing in priorities. And of course, there's also that sense of turning, but fundamentally in terms of identity, it's not that same sense of a new identity that's being given. It's a sense of simply the recovery or the fulfillment of your own identity. And I think that's what you see in the book of Acts and the New Testament, even for someone like Paul. For Paul can talk about it in his own, he has this dramatic turnaround that simply comes, that's got to do with his own biography. He is a persecutor and suddenly he becomes an apostle, And so that's this dramatic turnaround. But in fact, even for Paul, encountering the light of the Messiah on the road to Damascus is really, it's simply actually seeing the one who who he had been worshiping for his whole life, but recognizing in a deeper way who he really was. So.
And did some participants use the language of exile, return from exile, or stuff like that, or?
Now what I'm are you talking? You're talking about N.T. Wright?
No.
Okay. Say this again.
The participants of the inquiry.
Yes, you mean in this particular doctor? Yes, well, very much so. The sense of return, of restoration, of coming back to Israel's coming back to the land, and they're seeing, in some ways, seeing their own personal story as parallel to the whole story of the Jewish people's experience of exile and of return.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much. That was very prominent in that. But I think, by the way, her dissertation was done in English and at Hebrew University. And if any of you are interested,
do you know her name?
Carrie Warshawski, I think it is. I'm not sure I can. I think I have a copy, a PDF thing that I could that I could send out for anyone who is interested, so that if either Daniel. Or Hank, if you just remind me with an email, I can send it to you, and then anyone else could contact the view. It's extremely well done. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, Jesus being the embodiment of Israel, Israel Christology. I'm thinking about this text in Matthew. Jesus talking about the kingdom of God and the consequences of rejecting it. Somewhere said, well, I will give the fruit of it to people who will bring the fruit.
Yes.
What's the messianic Jewish view on that?
Yes.
That's dispensational, which I know.
Right. Well, I deal with that text in my first, in post-missionary messianic Judaism. I think the real question is, how do we deal with this term Laos, the term people, in that particular text? And now I would take a fairly lengthy discussion of the text in order for me to make the persuasive case for my own conclusion. But I'm just going to give you the conclusion I reach, and then if you want to pursue it more, you can read what the argument is in the book. And to some extent, I'm building on the work of Anthony Seldarini's interpretation of the text in his book on Matthew's, I think it's called Matthew's Christian Jewish Community, something like that. And my understanding is Laos there does not refer to the Jewish people as a whole. It's a reference instead to a group of leaders. Like the term In Hebrew, for example, the term Am, which is the equivalent of Laos, gets used not just of the people of Israel whole, it gets used of the Kohanim, of the priests. And within the particular context in Matthew of the parable of the vineyard, the real focus is on a replacement of a leadership group. The kingdom there is, I think, in effect, Israel. But what the main thrust is the replacement of the leaders of Israel, as opposed to the replacement of Israel. So
very important.
Yeah. Okay. Any? Did I see any other hands here? Okay, well, we'll need to end very soon. I'm just deciding whether it's worth my taking a couple of extra minutes here. Well, what I'm going to be talking about this in the next session then has to do with what does this mean for our understanding of ecclesiology. What impact does this have on our understanding of the ecclesia. I will be. I tend to want to use the term in my own writing and speaking. I'll use the Greek term, the Latin term, ecclesia, rather than the term church. And the reason I do that is because for most Jews and most Christians, the term church is a term that's used as a contrast to the Jewish people. You know, for some, it's to say Israel and the church as these two distinct entities, or the synagogue and the church. In either case, there's this sense that what you have is a church which is fundamentally a church of Gentiles. At least a church in which when Jews enter it, they are no longer part of this other reality, which is the synagogue or Israel or the Jewish people. And to contest that is, of course, one of the most fundamental parts of all of my own work. And so for me, what's crucial to always keep in view is the notion of the church as itself a what I call in post-missionary Messianic Judaism a bilateral reality, one that's made up of Jews and Gentiles in a way that actually gets expressed corporately and not just in having individual Jews who are part of what is otherwise largely a Gentile institution. I will be using the term ecclesia in place of the term church, or instead of the term church. That's not because I don't like the term church. It's very similar to why we as Messianic Jews, for example, prefer the term Messianic Jew rather than Christian. It's not because we think there's something wrong with the term Christian. It's because for what the term Christian communicates to most Jews, as well as, in fact, to most Christians, is a group that's distinct from Jews. If you're starting with that as your fundamental conceptual framework, and that is the one that most Jews and most Christians start with, then for me to say I'm a Christian immediately falsifies what I'm fundamentally trying to say. And so that'd be the reason why I don't use the term Christian to refer to myself, why I have no problem using the term Christian in reference to my non-Jewish brothers and sisters, Christian brothers and sisters. And similarly, that's why I would why I will use the term ecclesia rather than church. So I think that's enough of the introduction to the next session.
Do you think that New Testament writers on purpose used the word ecclesia because it was the translation of Kahal?
Yes.
Because there was also the better word synagogue.
Yeah.
It has been used in by John, for example.
Right.
As a synagogue to Satan.
Yes.
Can you speak up? Yeah. Can you repeat it?
Yeah.
Okay, yes. Hank's question is, do I think that the New Testament writers use the term ecclesia very deliberately instead of using the term synagogue, which is employed at the time to refer to these these other Jewish assemblies. Both of them were used in the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, to refer to the people of Israel. And so,
you might finish your answer.
Yes.
In the second lecture.
Good enough.
So we wish that you will participate in our brief ceremony, prayer and singing hymns. Let's stand together.